The Brad Sessmatt Show, broadcasting live from the Skyview Network Studios.
It's good Monday. Thanks for being with us. I am all smiles because I'm just getting pounded today because guarantee 3-0 didn't happen. Man, the Cardinals are just against the stinking Lions. And now they have the Panthers and they have the JETS Jets coming up here in the next couple weeks. And I don't know. We will have Kent Summers here at 10:20 to make sense of things. We will have Chris Cartman from Sun Devil Source at 10:45 to make sense of things around ASU returning to action, because I'm in full jinx mode. ASU is going to win the Pac-12 South when it comes to football. That is where I'm at today. Opening comments brought to you by Desert Financial Credit Union. Desert Financial Credit Union. The other day, I got a box with all sorts of stuff, goodies from Desert Financial Credit Union, because I'm a member. That's the way it works. You go into Desert Financial Credit Union, and they will take care of you and your family or your business on all your business fronts. Desert Financial Credit Union, a proud partner of us. We are proud to be with them. Sports360AZ.com. We appreciate their support. Here now is Eric Sorensen, Senior Executive Vice President of Everything or Nothing. How was your weekend?
Fine until yesterday. I mean, geez. Yikes. Yuck. Blech.
Blech. Did TCU win?
No, they lost.
So
why do you ask me questions you already know the answer to?
I'm not sure.
Why would you do that?
Because I saw I saw you put on your social media flying a flag out in front of your house.
Like I do for every game during the football season.
Do you have other neighbors that come down and are like, what is the deal?
No.
Is there like a TCU bar?
There is, but I just watch it at my house. It's better that way.
Yeah. So you had a loss on Saturday you had to deal with.
Yep.
And yesterday you had the Cardinal game, which was just, God, it was awful. It's a wasted weekend then. Right?
No, I mean, no. I, you know, we've been over this before. Like, I don't take a lot of stock in the first game of the college football season. Like, last week, you were like, oh my gosh, how horrible is Kansas State? They should just shut down the football program. They're so bad. Did Oklahoma win on Saturday, Brad? Did they win?
Did I say shut down the football program?
I mean, I might be exaggerating a little bit, but you thought, oh my gosh, they are so awful. They lost to the Sun Belt team.
They got better. Fun Belt.
The first game of the college football season is just a crapshoot.
Florida State is awful.
They are bad.
They're bad. I watched some of that. They're bad.
And Miami is good. Like those are two things we know.
Miami Clemson in 2 weeks. I've got that circled. I'm looking forward to that.
That'll be good for about a half.
You think?
Maybe three quarters.
Turnover chain is kind of not my thing when I watch Miami. It's a little too much turnover chain when your team's just been dreadful for so long.
I wonder if the Lions are thinking about bringing out their own turnover chain after
yesterday.
Gosh
almighty. It's not that, I mean, look, I watched a lot of college on Saturday and got out and chased a little white pill for a little bit. And
good.
You know, did you golf? No,
nope.
I didn't get out. All right. And then yesterday, I watched some of the Patriots game early and then sat and watched every last single play of that Cardinal disaster debacle, because Detroit's not good. They're just not good. I don't care. I don't care that they got back a player on off. I don't care if they got back some players. I don't care if they're a desperate team. You don't lose at home to Detroit in front of 750 fans. You just don't do it. And so I'm just a little angry today, I think is the only way I can put it. I'm not going to overreact. It is Overreaction Monday. We have every reason to. But honestly, Eric, am I the only one that was sitting there saying, are they ever going to throw the ball to Fitz? Are they ever going to throw the ball to Fitz? They're throwing to these guys that I've heard of Keyshawn Johnson. He's not the Keyshawn Johnson of give me the damn ball, but they targeted him 7 times. We have a Hall of Famer over here. What is going on? If I'm the Hall of Famer, do I want to keep playing? Like, do I want to really go out to practice? Like, you're a Hall of Famer, right? Fabiano's a Hall of Famer. Peter King is a Hall of Famer. If I barely acknowledged you in a show like in a crew, in a TV show, you would just be like, I'm retiring. I've had enough of this.
I mean, my credentials aren't like those credentials. So I'm not sure. I do know one thing. I know every single defensive coordinator on the Cardinals schedule from here on out is going to be studying that film from yesterday.
Yep.
Because, I mean, from an efficiency standpoint, Kyler was fine, but three interceptions. I mean,
well, one of those I'm not going to put on him. He got hit. He got hit in one of them. Yeah,
he did. But I mean, the offense was just not crisp. And I'm still stunned that Adrian Peterson. I mean, 22 carries for Adrian Peterson yesterday.
Right?
God.
Jeez. Right. Like Kenyon Drake is like, okay, we barely will use you. And now Buda Baker's hurt. So, you know, this player that is the highest paid at his position in the NFL, and injuries happen, but I'm not going to chalk that up to fake football in August. No, he got hurt during a game. It happens. But you have to go to Carolina. It's an early morning game. Rolled out this. They're going to win all these games and be 5-0 when they take on the Cowboys. And instead, even without Christian McCaffrey yesterday, they found a way, Carolina did, to beat the Chargers on the road.
Right. Going across country. What the Cardinals
Teddy Bridgewater.
Are gonna,
yeah.
The Cardinals are going to have to
Except the Cardinals are going on an early time clock. Carolina, I mean, it was no big deal. It's an afternoon game. So.
I wonder if the Cardinals started drinking the Kool-Aid like you and I did a little bit and did the Lions are coming to town. And I'm not saying they overlooked the Lions, but everyone and their brother thought the Cardinals were going to beat Detroit. I mean, let's just call it as it is.
Sure. I'm looking forward to tonight.
Great game.
Yeah. So to get to see Lamar Jackson and Patrick Mahomes. And you know, Monday Night Football, they've been given a lot of bad games. And I don't know if you read Peter or not this morning. We should let people know Peter is going to be back with us every week starting this Thursday. On the show. So Peter King with Football Morning America. Peter wrote today, the reason why ESPN got this game is the league looked at how good of a job that ESPN did with the NFL draft. And said, you know, and how they handled COVID and everything. That's how it works. Because you know CBS would have wanted this as a lead into 60 Minutes. You kidding me? Patrick Mahomes, Lamar Jackson, we have the AFC package. I know it's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff, but ESPN has been stuck with a lot of bad games in recent years with Monday Night Football, especially as the season progresses and they can't get out of those games.
I mean, look at the progression, Brad, from Thursday Night Football last week to Monday Night Football this week.
Yeah.
Jags-Dolphins, Packers-Saints, which was a really entertaining game, and then tonight, what should be the headliner, I would think. I mean, Ravens and Chiefs, that's an unbelievable matchup.
Yeah, and, you know, yesterday I found a way to watch a little bit of Dallas and Seattle because, you know, Cardinals-Detroit to me was not supposed to be something that I was going to be glued to. Like, but then it ended up becoming a game. So I felt like the weekend, like the college stuff for me, Bijan Robinson took a hit that I've never seen somebody take before in their game on Saturday. And I'm amazed he got up. Spencer Rattler lost a game, probably humbled him, probably is going to be a good thing for him down the road. Brock Purdy made a decision on a pass I've never seen in my life. It was such a poor decision. So, I mean, the college side and the NFL side, and we have high school starting this week. We'll get to that after Kent. But I thought all in all, and I'm glad the Diamondback season is over. I'm gonna just get right into that after Kent is done because we can't let the train wreck of the USS Titanic Diamondbacks go by the wayside.
No, that's not true. They won 4 out of their last 5 in the year. Come on. Yeah, they only finished 10 under.
Yeah. All right. We're going to talk about that a little bit. Up next, Kent Summers, columnist, AZ Central. What the heck happened yesterday from his view? That's next. And now, as promised, Kent Summers from AZ Central covers everything, columnist, but specifically for here, what the heck happened to the Cardinals yesterday? Come on now. Come on. I mean, what happened?
Well, one, they, you know, the old desperate team mantra in the NFL played out. Detroit had, you know, 11 straight losses. You know, Matt Patricia on the hot seat. It was a desperate team. They played like it. The Cardinals did not. Just some breakdowns for the Cardinals. You know, offensively, it's a team that's still not clicking yet, in particular Kyler Murray and the passing game. And defensively, we saw some breakdowns. Played well at times, yeah. Then gave up a 75-yard drive at the end of the first half, 70-yard drive at the end of the second half for the game-winning field goal for the Lions.
Kent Summers with us, AZ Central sports columnist. Let's dive deep into Cliff Kingsbury then. 2-1, second season. What do you like? What concerns you about the head coach?
I like what they do on offense. You can see the creativity. You can see the play calling. You can see that group getting better. What I didn't like, and especially against the Lions, is I think a creative play caller got too creative, got too out of sorts when you're playing a team where the simple stuff will work. I mean, the Lions could not stop the run in their first two games. Why the Cardinals didn't stick with that at times, I think it was a third quarter, Kenyon Drake gains 15 yards for a first down. Then they throw the ball the next three times. And two of those passes are to Keyshawn Johnson, a second-year receiver. And why Keyshawn Johnson's getting seven targets in a game and Larry Fitzgerald gets two, and one reception for 0 yards, I have no idea. Kingsbury, to his credit, admitted his failings, you know, after the game. He took full blame for that, said I didn't do a very good job, and there's really no one who will disagree with him. I think what they've got to do getting forward, they've got to get Kyler Murray on a roll as a passer. We've seen what he can do with his legs. We saw it again with the Lions on the one-yard touchdown run. But I think they could see a lot more of what the Lions did to them yesterday. Discipline plus rush lanes, a lot of zones, so their eyes are on Murray. Limit him as a runner and make him pass and try to make him pass from the pocket. And there were struggles yesterday doing that.
It's his second season, and we've seen him progress so much, and they're raving about his ability to make moves in the open field. That's all well and good, but tape don't lie, as they like to say. And the tape is now out there, and teams, have they figured Kyler Murray out a little bit? Is it just 1 week? Is it just that the head coach did not get to page three of his playbook? I don't know. What do you think on the Murray front and what you see in his progress?
I think it's just 1 week. I think he's going to be really, really good. I think he's going to be a star in the league. But I also think two things. Way premature to talk about him as an MVP candidate. Just yeah. Because it was his second year and Patrick Mahomes and Lamar Jackson did it does not make him an MVP candidate. On the other extreme, he had a bad game. It does not mean he stinks, doesn't have a future in the league. Cliff Kingsbury is an idiot. You know, those things are true. It happens in the NFL. And what the Cardinals have got to obviously stop, they've got to stop it here. I mean, they've got a road game at Carolina, very winnable against a 1-2 Carolina team, and then go play the worst team in the league in the Jets. They need to be 4-1 before they go to that Monday night game in Dallas because the schedule gets much harder after that. But I don't see the call to arms and the panic. I don't see a reason for that yet, but I do see a reason for improvement. I actually think they have bigger questions on defense now than they do on offense. There's a history. The offense is going to be better. We saw it last year. Defensively, now they're banged up in the secondary. They're down to their fourth or fifth safety. And we saw Lions and Matthew Stafford exploit that on Sunday.
Kent Summers with us. Let's flip over off the field for a minute on where things are with Steve Keim. You wrote about this last week. I think Steve has been in a space where he was completely under siege. I thought that he was going to be out of here last season very early on. I think a lot of people felt the same way. Do you look at him now and say, regardless of what happens, he's going to survive here in Arizona because of his tightness with Michael, and he's had more hits than misses?
Yeah, I think he's safe because I think they're going to be better this season. Now, if the whole thing crumbles and they go 3-13, who knows? But I think you look at this roster, and there's no question it's far more talented than it's been the last 2 years. And I know that's a backhanded compliment because 2018 was one of the worst teams in franchise history, which you and I know, especially as saying something.
Yeah.
2019, you could see the progress. But I think he has bounced back. You can see some key free agent signings on defense. who have helped, Devondre Campbell, Devin Kennard, Dre Kirkpatrick. I think you can see, you know, I mean, getting DeAndre Hopkins, I still don't know how he did that and give up and get out from under David Johnson's contract in the process. So I think he's fine. I can see them rebuilding, but I also think, and he acknowledged this in an interview with me, he's fortunate to have a job. There aren't many general managers that get a chance basically to rebuild a roster twice in the same tenure. And he is getting that chance. And so far it looks like they might do it, but this is a pivotal year. They need to, you know, they need to finish the 9-7 and show growth to me. That would be progress.
Where do you see Larry Fitzgerald at with this organization? As long as he wants to play Sunday, they barely target him. Where do you see Fitz at in all this?
I think it would be a really hard thing for Michael Bidwell to go to Larry Fitzgerald and say, you know, we're not giving you $11 million again. You know, if you want to play for 3 or 4 and know that you're going to be the fourth or fifth option on this team, because that's what it's been so far.
Yep.
And I don't know. It's so early. Obviously, I don't think Fitzgerald would want to come back for an 18th season getting 2 targets a game and being a fifth wheel. I just don't see that. And but I don't think that's going to be the case. I think Kingsbury is going to make an effort to get him the ball. I think, but it makes for a difficult balance for Kingsbury. He's got to get Hopkins the ball. He wants to get Kenyon Drake the ball. He wants to get Fitz the ball. He loves Andy Isabella. He thinks Christian Kirk could be a star. You know, it's in the NFL where there's 65 plays a game. It's just not enough for everybody to touch the ball that many times every week. That somebody is not going to be satisfied.
And I'm going to go behind the curtain on this a little bit. It's very difficult to get to players and to ask them these types of questions in this current environment, because you have 30 reporters all sitting there, all wanting the same thing. So to pull a player aside and say, hey, between us, how's this working out for you? We simply don't know, right?
Yeah, right. It's what we all deal with. I'm not complaining, but it's so hard to even ask a follow-up question on Zoom. And it's hard for guys too, you know, from their point, it's got to be hard to be interviewed. It's like Herm Edwards said last week in a conference call, I'm tired of living life in that little box on Zoom. You know, I'm in a box. And I think we all kind of feel like that. But I've covered Fitz for his entire NFL career. He'll never complain publicly about lack of stats. Privately, he's like every other receiver I've ever known. He wants the ball. He thinks he can make a difference. And he thinks he can make a difference catching the ball, not just doing things like he did against the 49ers, grabbing it and getting it to the official quickly so they can kick a field goal. He still wants to catch the game-winning pass. And if he's not given those opportunities throughout this season, then it may not be a Cardinals decision. It may be a Larry Fitzgerald decision. It's like, okay, I'm done after 17 years.
Interesting. Good way to put it. Kent Summers with us. Before I get you out of here, NFC West through 3 weeks. Clearly the toughest division from my view. I look at the Cardinals and I don't see where they are with Seattle right now, from my humble opinion. What do you see in the NFC West?
Yeah, I see Seattle's rolling. Russell Wilson is better than ever, and that's saying something. He has some weapons at receiver now. I think the question with that team is defensively, can they stand up? Can they hold up? Is it realistic to ask Russell Wilson to throw 4 touchdown passes a week? I don't think so. I thought the Rams maybe were showing progress until they sort of fall apart yesterday, you know, Sunday. I like what the 49ers have done. They've shown some real toughness. I know back-to-back wins over the Giants and the Jets are nothing to crow about, but given their number of injuries and how easy they won those games, that's really impressive. So I wouldn't dismiss the 49ers if they can shore up from those injuries. But right now, it looks like Seattle is a couple steps above everybody. San Francisco second, and it looks like maybe the Rams and Cardinals are still trying to figure out who they are.
Good stuff. I appreciate your time as always, and stay safe.
Thanks, Brad.
There's Kent Summers with us, and we are back with more after this timeout. As promised, Chris Cartman now, Sun Devil source. None knows more and tells more than Chris Cartman when it comes to Arizona State and other things, too. We just like having Chris on because I want to get right off the top the Pac-12 and how they handled everything from your view at Sun Devil source. You've been around this conference a long, long time. How do you think the Pac-12 handled the return, or actually the delay and then the return?
Not particularly well. Overall, Brad, you have some things that were positive. They were first to work with a company to get the rapid test result opportunity lined up, which was a positive development. That's, I think, key for the doctors who were independent. I also like the fact that they had independent experts, not just people who were tethered to the conferences like in other places that had incentive to rule in favor of a return to football. There's some aspects about the Pac-12's academic reputation that I think were kind of on the line as the president saw it. They didn't want to put student athletes in harm's way, so I respect that. But the problem that they had is as soon as they signed up Quidel to that rapid test opportunity, they should have been working with the state and local government in the Bay Area, LA County, and then also in Oregon to alleviate those restrictions on the workouts, the cohorting, and all of that. And they didn't for about a 2-week period. I think that had they had their athletes returning to campus while the protocols were being approved in those six schools, they probably could have started on October 31st. There were challenges, I think, associated with the discrepancy between workouts that were available to athletes in the other states versus those states that maybe led to some political decisions on the part of the president and even coaches about when they would be ready to play. So I have to give them fair marks overall.
I have a problem back on the Quidel part where Larry Scott stands up and trumpets it as a big deal in a press conference. And then it comes out that U of A had already done this and other colleges, SMU most notably, but there were other colleges across the country that had already put this rapid response test into place with that same company. And so to me, it just looked like, okay, they finally agreed on the dollars. Am I missing something here? Because it was already out there, Chris.
Well, yes, and ASU had its own version of a relatively rapid test as well that was in development. The problem, though, I think, Brad, is that the Pac-12 wanted everyone to have access to the same protocol and process. And if you had one team that had an advantage or two or three because they had way better testing capability and they weren't going to have as many players go down due to either testing positive or contact tracing and the disadvantage that they perceive that might cause associated with it, because a lot of the schools did not have the access to those tests.
Fair point. Chris Cartman with a Sun Devil source, knows all, tells all around Arizona State. All right. I don't know if I'm jinxing them. I think they should win the South. I feel like because of what happened in California, where those schools were at a disadvantage over the last 4 or 5 months, I have to believe behind the scenes ASU is further ahead than others within the South. Am I wrong here?
You're not wrong. I wrote an article about this just the other day, actually, talking about how ASU was able to have 15 straight weeks of workouts, and they were able to have on-field instruction, which is typically not permitted from the end of spring ball through the end of July. So they actually got over 100 hours of coaching, essentially, through their new offensive and defensive schemes, plus 100-plus hours of strength and conditioning. And remember, Stanford, Cal, some of these other schools, they have extreme restrictions. They couldn't even have 12 people together at any point in time anywhere. So, and then they had, people that have my job around the Pac-12, every single school, with the exception of maybe Utah, has had players off of their campuses for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, even more than that in some cases, with breaks in what they were able to do from a workout standpoint. So ASU should have more fluency than would typically be the case for their new schemes going into any given season, which sounds weird, but it is true. And then when you also overlay this with Oregon having four of its top players opt out, USC's had multiple players who were their best guys opt out, and Cal and Stanford and other schools. I think Utah is the closest to ASU in terms of what they've been able to do from a workout and a football standpoint, but they have to replace so much more of their star talent that I think that gives ASU a little bit of an edge. So I had USC ahead of ASU prior to all of these kind of developments, and now I think it's really kind of a neck and neck thing for those two teams in the South.
And I think you and I are cut from the same cloth. We're not ones to walk around and honk maroon and gold. I mean, we just do what we do. But this would be a major disappointment to me if we don't know what the bowls are even going to look like. But there really is no reason to be showing up in El Paso or Las Vegas or San Francisco anymore under Herm Edwards, in my opinion. And this would be the first start. I get it. It's a weird year. I understand that. But there's entirely too much talent on this roster to be settling for second and third tier bowl games.
Right. So they do have to replace a lot of their offensive skill pieces. But when you have Jaden Daniels, that makes it a lot easier, obviously. The way I look at this season, and we'll have to see what the new schedule reveals, but I thought that if they took any step backwards, that would have been in the win-loss column I'm talking about, that would have been a real problem. That should not happen. So if they had played a 12-game schedule, they should have won 8 games or more. And I would say if they're playing a 7-game schedule, a 4-3 is probably not good enough. I think 5-2 is sort of the minimum barometer of what you would consider to be a good season. And maybe they have a difficult schedule. We'll have to see about that. But that's sort of my before you get a look at exactly what it looks like, first blush opinion.
All right, so there's fans that are watching this that have not been paying attention because ASU's been off the radar. People have been distracted by COVID for whatever reason. So there's a segment here that has not been following recruiting close, if at all. A player or two that fans should keep an eye out on that they're not hearing or reading about much yet because it always seems to go back to Jaden Daniels and everybody else.
Well, two freshman receivers who are very highly regarded that I think will make an immediate impact. LV Bunkley Shelton is a slot type receiver. He's an excellent route runner for a first year player at ASU. He's competitive, well put together. I think he's got a lot of things going for him that lend itself to him being out there and making a lot of catches early as a Sun Devil. And then Johnny Wilson is, sounds hard to believe, but he's 6'7". He's 225 pounds, and he runs a legitimate 4.45 40-yard dash. Mm. He's one of the fastest players on ASU's team. He's going to be a hybrid type of a player, so you can move him around formationally. You can play tight as like an extra tight end, but a route runner. You can move him outside. He's a mismatch problem, a red zone type of a guy. I think those two, and then Diamante Trainum is a running back who enrolled early. And it was very obvious that he was a cut above most freshmen from a physical standpoint, every bit of 225 pounds, thick but flexible, strong, has good instincts. He picked ASU, Brad, over Michigan, Ohio State, right. Penn State, and Wisconsin out of the state of Ohio. So that's out of the state. Yeah, so that's unbelievable, right, when you get something like that happening.
Chris Cartman with a Sun Devil source. A couple other things I'll get you out of here, and I appreciate your time as always. Ray Anderson, to me, was a shining star during all of this with COVID in the Pac-12. But I'll even go back last year when they had the officiating scandal with replay, and Ray got involved in that. Chris, in my opinion, Ray should be running the Pac-12 conference in some way, shape, or form. It's no disrespect to Arizona State. It used to be a job that guys groomed and got on with. Kevin White was one, went from here to Notre Dame to Duke. Gene Smith was the other. I think Ray's done very well at Arizona State, though there's some on the basketball side that say, well, he had a rogue booster. Okay. Your view on how Ray's standing is within the conference and Larry Scott just getting hammered from all sides?
Well, he's very well regarded in the Pac-12, one of the top two or three ADs in terms of reputation and how much he's relied upon from his background and his knowledge base. I just don't see Ray Anderson having any real interest in positioning, jockeying, or even really considering replacing Larry Scott. And I do think that Larry Scott may not be the commissioner in another year or 2 years, right? That's I think that's a strong chance of that happening. But I would more so say that Ray Anderson is likely to be involved in the process that determines who should replace Larry Scott versus throwing his hat into the ring as a candidate. Just where he's at in his career, he really enjoys being at ASU, living in the Valley. There's some things that he wants to accomplish. I think you touched on it from the basketball side, with the Desert Financial Arena and some other things that really can cement his legacy from a facilities revenue, getting through this COVID situation over the next year or two. Those can go a long way, especially if he retires as an ASU athletic director versus the guys that you mentioned previously, like Gene Smith going to Ohio State or Kevin White going to Notre Dame. Lisa Love's tenure obviously didn't end successfully. So
no.
He has the ability to put himself on a different kind of a tier. And I think he's very happy ultimately retiring and living in the Valley for a long time to come.
Switch over to basketball. Expectations for Bobby Hurley's team. Obviously, you've got players that are being looked at as lottery candidates. It's been discussed quite a bit. But you had Romello White leave out of the program. Remy comes back. You follow this stuff. What do you think ASU basketball for this season?
So clearly, the center position is their big question mark. You know, they have some options there. I think Jalen Graham probably was capable even more than he demonstrated last year. Yep. I thought their lineups where they had Romello White and Jalen Graham on the floor together were pretty dynamic and challenging for some opponents. So I think he could take a big step if he's used the last 6 months effectively from a strength and conditioning standpoint, gaining size and everything. Their guard play is tremendous. Some of the best in the country. I think everybody knows that. Remy Martin's a candidate for player of the year. Josh Christopher, had he been in this coming year's NBA draft, would probably be a top five pick. It's a down draft. He is a James Harden type of a power scoring guard, extremely potent. I think Alonzo Verge, everybody knows, was one of the better guards in the conference by the end of last season, right? So the forecasts that have them in the top 20, and there are three or four prominent ones, I think that they're legitimate. The overall talent level in college basketball is kind of down. The best players tend to leave early. ASU has some veteran seniors and juniors who are established and have done it. If they're not neck and neck with like UCLA for the championship, I think that that would be, not achieving to their potential this year. I mean, they're, in my mind, neck and neck with the Bruins as far as having the most back in a guard-heavy league. There's not a lot of post strength. So where their weaknesses are, other teams don't really have the ability to take too much advantage of them. And there's just a lot of things from a synergistic standpoint, their success, having won 20 games, the ideology of understanding what it takes to be successful, that all kind of line up for this being Bobby Hurley's best season.
Yeah. You and I are sitting here talking very optimistically about football and basketball, which is something that when we hear the sleeping giant narrative forever, it feels like. This is a year where I can't use COVID with basketball or football and say, well, we had this delay, because there's entirely too much. Expectations should be very, very high this year on both fronts.
Oh, I agree very much. I think the football team should be one of the better teams in the conference, all things considered, basketball as well. And I think if you look beyond this year, even talking about your sleeping giant analogy, the football team should probably even be better in the fall of 2021. They are going to have mostly seniors and juniors starting on defense. Jaden Daniels will be back. They will have assimilated all of these new four-star recruits on the offensive skill positions. Most of their offensive linemen will be intact. The recruiting piece for Herm Edwards is going very well. They're top 20 in the country right now with their 2021 class. They have the potential, I think, to put together four classes in a row better than anyone has done at ASU in the last 30 years. So all signs kind of point to, with their revenue sports at least, a lot of positive things kind of all coming together for the Sun Devils.
It's always good to catch up with you. Great insight, as always. Stay well. Thanks.
Enjoyed it, Brad. Thank you.
There's Chris Cartman, SunDevilSource.com. Check out all of his content at SunDevilSource.com, publisher, editor, at sundevilsource.com. And we're back with more after this timeout. All right, so this is a big week for the high school part of our football world because they get to play on Friday night. And we're very happy with this. We have not talked anything about different parts of the state still being out, not being able to play, even though there still are those places. But by and large, what would you think, Eric? 90% of high schools are going to be playing football this Friday?
I think in the greater Phoenix area, almost 100% of the schools are going to be playing. In northern Arizona, I know Flagstaff's run into some complications, and we all know what's happening down in Tucson. But yeah, for the most part, almost all the Valley teams will be playing.
Yeah, and then like we were talking with Chris about Cartman on ASU's front. So they're going to start. We have not gotten a schedule yet. Don't know when they're practicing as of yet, but to think they haven't touched a football in a few months would be naive.
I think last week they said practices were going to start October 7th or 8th, and Larry Scott said that this week, early this week, we will have schedules. So
yeah. And so, you know, I'm excited for Friday. It feels like we're getting into a little bit of normalcy. I've heard out in my area that there's some COVID things going on at some high schools, so I am holding my breath a little bit. A personal note that we're supposed to do some offensive line training, and a family had COVID, and so they had to cancel. So it's out there, and it's high school kids, so you just have to hold your breath, like we've seen on the collegiate end, where you've had programs like Houston that still are not out on the field yet. Yeah. I think it's 3 weeks in a row they've been canceled. So, you know, on the college end, so did you watch much of Miami?
I didn't watch a lot. I watched bits and pieces.
So De'Ara King, to me, has been a obviously he and KJ Costello, two transfer quarterbacks that have made huge differences. The KJ Costello I saw at Stanford versus the KJ Costello that's playing for Mike Leach, night and day. And Mike Leach in the SEC, you talk about gold. And they just jack-stomped LSU. Just crushed them.
I almost texted you on Saturday, Brad, because I saw the most Mike Leach thing at the end of that game. So Mississippi State was ahead by 10 points. Okay, they had the ball. They were on the plus side of the field. So they were inside LSU territory, okay? It's 2nd and 7, all right? Mike Leach calls a passing play. They're up 10 points. Run the ball. But he's just going to do it his way. He doesn't care. I think it was an incomplete pass. And he just, like, everything that is supposed to happen, like the blueprint for college coaches and game scripts. Right. Like Mike Leach's like, no, we're just going to do it this way. Like, I don't care if it's the Big 12 or the Pac-12 or the SEC. I am not going to change the way I do things.
When he plays against Nick Saban for the first time, that week will be so much fun. He was talking about pumpkin spice latte stuff yesterday. It's just typical.
I believe it.
Like, I'm going to talk about my pumpkin spice because it's that time of the year, even though he just came off an enormous victory. And to just take LSU and throw them around, and I don't care if LSU only has 4 starters returning. It's L, capital S, capital U.
I will say that I think a big part of that game was you go to Death Valley and play a day game in front of 20,000 people. It's a lot different, obviously, than playing a night game in front of 110,000.
Are you trying to take away stuff from Mike Leach?
I am not.
Are you trying to downplay it?
But I just think that is a huge deal in college football. Because college football is a game of emotions. It's a game of passion. It's a game of bands and cheerleaders and student section and tailgating. And you're really not seeing much of any of that at these games.
Do you think that's why Texas got into a shootout with Texas Tech?
No, those teams always play close. So I'm not surprised.
Like that close? To me, I was surprised by that one.
I really wasn't.
And if you
Because I still don't think Texas is... I don't think they're a top 10 team. Do I think they're a top 25 team? I do. Do I think they're the 8th best team in the country? I don't. So
how can you even tell this year, though? Like the whole reputation of teams, which is part of college football, is is so blown out of proportion. Like, if you're the Big 12, okay, and Oklahoma loses to Kansas State, and Kansas State lost a few weeks earlier, and every year Oklahoma gets, or last 2 years, Oklahoma gets into the postseason, and they get jack stomped.
Yep.
So are we just supposed to look at the Big 12 and say, you know what, they're really not any good? And if you're the Pac-12, if a team in the Pac-12 runs, let's just say it's Arizona State, okay, and they're sitting there and they're undefeated, and Oklahoma doesn't lose another game, but they got crushed by Kansas State. Where's the Pac-12 at in all this?
I think I definitely think that an undefeated Pac-12 school would make it over a one-loss Big 12 school. And yes, Oklahoma did get destroyed, but that LSU team that beat them last year was probably one of the most well-rounded teams in college football history. They cut through every team in the SEC, and they rolled right past Clemson in the championship game. So, grain of salt. And I don't know if you took Oklahoma out, I don't know who the team that would replace them would be, unless you took one of the SEC schools that played a tougher schedule and had one loss, and I'd be okay with that.
Okay, so where's Miami of Florida at? In 2 weeks, if they beat Clemson, which you don't think they will from what you said earlier in the show.
I don't.
Okay, but if they did, in that conference, are you already saying it's a one-bid league?
I am, because
Miami beats Clemson, Clemson doesn't make it?
I would think so. I would think so. Because Alabama's probably going to be one of the teams. And I don't know. I mean, what you would think Ohio State would probably be one of the teams,
you're
depending
going off
on
reputation
how they
again.
Do that.
You're going off reputation. You're going off reputation again.
As well, I should. Ohio State's either won the national championship, been in the CFP, or won the Rose Bowl. I mean, those are you can't really get much if you're looking at resumes, Brad. Like
I have to look at on the field, like what Mike Leach did Saturday. Puts them in a conversation of they could be in the CFP because they have a win over a resume team.
They do.
If you beat a resume team, that doesn't mean Kansas State is in there because Kansas State had lost earlier.
Right.
I think, too, that in this weird year, that there's going to be a little bit of people looking at who's leading the team. And I go over to Herm Edwards. Herm is a media darling. ESPN was gushing over him on game day on Saturday.
Of course.
Yes.
In related news, the sun is hot.
I get it, but in this weird year, okay, I think there's going to be a lot of perceptions that aren't really realities. And if you can tell a great story and you can bring some more eyeballs to the plate in a year where everybody's going to be dying for money, you're not going to take a team that is, I don't know, is not as sexy, I guess, is the way to put it. And I think that plays well for ASU. I know I'm intimating that the CFP is going to have some things outside of just eyeballs that they're looking at this year. But I do believe that to be the case. Herm has stayed out there in front of everybody. Have you seen anything out of Oregon or Washington? No.
It's true. I guess when you're talking about Ohio State, I mean, the one common theme we see every year in the CFP is elite quarterback play. Last year, Trevor Lawrence, Jalen Hurts,
Joe Burrow.
Justin Fields, Joe Burrow. Like, those are the four best quarterbacks in college football.
You're right. You're right.
And Justin Fields is back this year, and Ohio State is loaded. So I'm not really reinventing the wheel saying I think Ohio State's going to make it to the CFP. And I think, Brad, honestly, I do think reputation, like the blue blood programs are going to get the benefit of the doubt over the good storyline.
Yeah, but they should.
We've seen that before. I know. I know, but we've just seen that. That's all.
Like saying Notre Dame should be in there every year because there's a segment out there that is saying, well, wait till Notre Dame gets done. Well,
yeah.
Notre Dame does not have to play against USC this year. And I know that USC is sitting out there saying, you know, like, I watched BYU the other night, and they're trying to hype it up, the BYU-Troy game, as, you know, this could put BYU in a conversation. Like, come on, guys. Don't. Now, that is a reach.
They were like 23.5-point home favorites.
That is a reach. And I found myself watching some of Troy against BYU.
Well, that was the only option.
I'm a sucker. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, there was nothing else on. That's one of the downfalls of only having three of the five power conferences. Because you just don't have the same amount of games every Saturday to watch.
Yeah. All right. We're done. We have to go work on a TV show now. So we'll see you later. There's Eric Sorensen, Senior Executive Vice President of Nothing or Everything, depending on the day. Jared Nielsen is our Chairman of the Board. He's the Iron Man. He puts everything together. This show repeats over and over and over and over and over. If you missed any part of Kent Summers or Chris Karpman, you can check it out. Have yourself a great day.